The following is a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.
This is Hi-Fi Radio with Wolfgang Klein and Jack Hardim. Toronto's news, today's talk, 640 Toronto.
Well, good evening, my friends. We're halfway through the month of September. Usually the toughest month in the market. We are surviving. Market's been pretty good this year, if you're in the right things. And it's funny, those right things were cold, and they went hot, and they pulled back a little bit, and they're waking up, and that's technology. Oil's getting a bit of a bid, too, I must say. Quiet riot in crude oil. Ooh, so dirty, they say, but we still consume the stuff, lots of it. Had a great presentation, Jack, with Canoe's team talking about crude and barrels consumed per person in North America. 20 barrels of oil consumed by each and every one of us each and every year. In emerging markets, China, India, about 3 barrels per year consumed. And we know what the trajectory of that is.
I would say slightly down, I'm going to say, for developing or developed markets, but developing for sure. They want to normalize and get up to that. Even if they get up to 7 barrels a day, it's significant in terms of the global oil picture.
Oh, goodness gracious. You think about it, over 2.5 billion people taking consumption of crude from 3 to 4 barrels. Significant. 3 to 7. 3 to 20 where we're at. Incredible. But on the other side of that equation is electrification of the world. Tesla got a little pop on its Dojo line, shall I say. That's the self-driving vehicle, isn't it?
I'm going to say it's the engine that drives the self-driving vehicle. So it's the artificial intelligence. And now Tesla is jumping on that bandwagon of artificial intelligence, gathering data and starting to monetize it.
It's remarkable. Michael Hainsworth, he knows this space very well. Formerly of BNN, he used to interview me frequently on that station. He was tough, I must say. Kept me sharp. Michael, welcome back. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well. Can you believe Elon Musk named a supercomputer a Dojo? Is this the biggest 13-year-old boy you've ever met or what?
You gotta like him. You really do.
No, you don't.
Yeah. Well, okay. I like him. I like him a lot, actually. I think he just keeps keeps all of us alert as to what's next. He is in charge in part to the future. Question for you, Hainsworth, Mr. Host of Where's My Jetpack? Have you seen the movie The Current War?
No, I haven't. Should I?
You should. It's the race. During 1872, Thomas Edison versus George Westinghouse, and throw into the equation, what was his name? Nikola Tesla. Great movie. Yeah, it's all about electrification and AC versus DC current. And Thomas Edison, of course, had the light bulb after about 1,000 failures. George Westinghouse was the creator of the air brake for the locomotive engines and then parlayed his talents into the discovery of electricity and trying to light up the world. Great movie, Michael. You're going to absolutely love it. But that said, Tesla, of course, reinvented automotive, remarkably so. But he just doesn't stop there. As a matter of fact, we're getting frustrated with our telecom at home, Michael, and we were looking at hooking up with, what is it called, Starlink, his global communication network that is quietly also, you know, gaining some traction?
Yeah, the Starlink system, the satellite-based internet service that Elon Musk refused to help the Ukrainians with in their fight against the invading Russians. I know all about that.
I thought he did open that up to them.
Yeah, but only a little bit. When he found out that they were planning to attack some naval warships, he decided he didn't want to be involved in that, and so he wouldn't give them the ability to extend the network into that part of the world. But your movie analogy is actually quite apt, because Edison was all about DC current electricity, mm-hmm. and Westinghouse was all about alternating current, which, as you know, AC is what comes out of the walls of our homes. Same thing for Elon Musk with Tesla. Tesla Dojo is a supercomputer that pulls in an insane amount of video data captured from real-life driving situations on the 4 million cars that are on the road already that are Tesla. And the reason why is because he decided he did not want to go with the equivalent of alternating current for self-driving cars, which is LiDAR. Everything is done by way of cameras, and that is a heck of a lot more difficult. And as a result of it being that much more difficult, he needs that supercomputer to be able to crunch all of the data to ensure that his self-driving cars don't run into other people. And other competitors are using LiDAR. It's more expensive, but it's also more efficient.
Michael, Apple car, Tesla phone, which hits the market first, or neither?
Apple Car is years away, if at all. The people who were working on the Apple Car have actually found themselves redirected to the Apple Vision Pro augmented reality, virtual reality headset to a large degree. That's expected to push out the Apple Car by about 5 to 10 years.
So in your world, where's my jetpack? What's catching your attention?
What's catching my attention is that Apple is being forced to switch to USB-C by the European Union for all of their phones. It's a law by the end of next year. It'll extend to laptops by 2026 as well, and it's intended to reduce the e-waste from 11,000 tons of discarded chargers every year. But the switch to USB-C may just be the start. Apple's already blinked on this. Now they may have to blink as well on right to repair. The EU is demanding customers have the right to replace iPhone batteries as well. Remember back in the olden days when you dropped your phone and the battery would come skidding out onto the street? That is the fear that Apple has, that if we drop an iPhone, it'll split into two. They don't want that, but the EU says you're going to have to do that. So they blinked once, they may have to blink twice.
I'm sorry, but back up. What is this, I think you said USB-C you're referring to. I'm not aware of it.
Well, if you plug your iPhone in to charge it, right now you're using a Lightning connector, which is a proprietary connector. USB-C is found everywhere and anywhere for charging all sorts of devices. And as a result, the fear here is that when you switch from, say, an Apple to a Samsung or what have you, you're going to throw out your old charger. You have to buy Apple's proprietary charger in the first place. So what we're hoping to see here is that everybody's using the same tech for the same reason. Apple, unfortunately, is not going to get its piece of the pie when somebody sells a Lightning connector-based product. Apple would originally get a little bit from the licensing to make that possible. That's not going to happen under USB-C.
Well, I just came from a fantastic two-week journey, a get-to-know-your-family-heritage-family trip to Ireland and Germany. And it was great to see the charging stations quite frequently throughout both countries. ABB doing a lot of the charging stations. And I wasn't seeing Teslas being plugged in. No, I was seeing a lot of Chinese vehicles getting charged. Cost about, I'd say, 35 euro to charge your vehicle as opposed to 80 to 100 euro to fill it up with petrol. But this, a significant charge, not free, but standardized. So is this basically what's happening to devices, standardized charging?
It's the exact same kind of issue. You're on a plane. The person beside you needs to borrow your charger. Oops, not compatible. But everything else is possible, so that's going to come soon.
What about the new Samsung split phone? I'm not even sure if that's what it's called. It looks like a book. And I'm sure you've seen it, Michael. You're all over this stuff here. I saw quite a few of them in Europe. And then at a presentation yesterday, Jack, I don't know if you noticed at lunch, one of those fellas sitting at our table had a Samsung flip phone. So it's basically twice the size of my iPhone. It's got a spine. You can open it up. Have you seen that product, Michael? Does it have legs if you have seen it?
I have seen it. Some people absolutely love it, particularly if you don't have a lot of pocket space. And if you ask a woman, one of the biggest complaints they'll give you is that women's clothing doesn't have pockets. And when it does, they're super small. This almost turns your phone into like a makeup compact kind of.
There's two types. Back. Yeah, no, there's two types. The one that flips in half, I guess, top down, and one that opens up left to right. The left to right one is twice the size of my iPhone. You put a case on that puppy, and it's pretty chunky. I saw a pretty funky case for it, a high-tech case. But then, yes, his partner, who was female, of course, or not, of course, she had the one that looked like a makeup case, and it flipped top down. That was intriguing. But the one that opened up like a book, I found more interesting because, well, as we get older, which I am, that's for sure, having trouble to see, bigger screen certainly helps me a lot.
You're absolutely right. Bigger screen, not just because of your aging eyes, but also because it's now often people's primary form of communication and media consumption. Bigger screen, better for Netflix and chill, my friend.
Hey, what about the writer's strike, Michael? Is there an end in sight? We're getting frustrated. Tesla as a stock was working quite well. Disney, of course, not. But we need content. Any inklings as to when that writer's strike is going to be settled?
Absolutely not. But what it does mean is that the demand for non-written content, like the kind of material that I produce, is going up. And so the phone is ringing off the hook, as I'm sure you can hear.
Oh, Michael Hainsworth in demand. How's your career unfolding post-television anchor at a national scale?
I can't believe I didn't do it sooner, my friend.
Are you getting a lot of corporate engagements?
A lot of corporate engagements, clients, Nokia, Microsoft, CIBC, all very interested in telling interesting stories about the world in which we all operate. My favorite one was off to London to speak to the founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales, about the future of truth in the age of alternative facts. He's optimistic. We can win.
Wow. Give us some more.
The ultimate issue is that boomers are the ones who are spreading the disinformation more than anyone else. We will educate them or they will die, literally and figuratively. And with that in mind, the next generation, Gen Z, millennials, they're the ones who are a little more in tune to this.
Do you remember visions and predictions about Generation X, the lost generation, the disenfranchised generation, the generation that was very much into IT but never bathed generation?
Dude, I am Gen X. We are the forgotten generation even now. The millennials are fighting with the boomers. The boomers are fighting with the millennials. And, you know, the rest of us are just sitting here eating popcorn watching this unfold.
Yeah, it's quite true because I saw a little joke about various generations and basically depicting that the Gen X is the only happy generation out there. I think it's a complete myth. It's an exciting time, just to say the least. The fall is upon us. Markets tend to get a little perkier. Pay attention to technology. It is a driving force. Getting a little pricier, but exciting nonetheless. Mr. Michael Hainsworth, IDC contributing editor and host of Where's My Jetpack? He's awesome. I want to thank you for your time, my friend.
Thank you.
You keep it up, and we'll get you back on Hi-Fi Radio ever so soon. Friends, we're going to take a quick break and get back to the show with money talk. We're going to do a little behavioral finance with...
Amos Nadler, Wolf.
Amos Nadler.
Back to school.
A former professor at the... was it?
Ivy School of Business at Western.
Nice.
Yeah.
And now he's in the corporate world trying to help people make better decisions, and you do that by not getting in your own way. Stay tuned.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Hi-Fi Radio in a moment on 640 Toronto. You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.
Welcome back to a show about money. I am Wolfgang Klein, Jack Hartle by my side. We're two portfolio managers that care a lot about helping good people build wealth. If you need some help, please, we're here for you. Just drop us a line. Indeed, you know, I got to say, there's a lot of wisdom in buy and hold. Truly is. And I think the biggest lesson learned from buy and hold is you don't have to make that difficult decision of getting back in. I share with you people who panicked in the market at the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. People panicked and got nervous, exited the market when the S&P 500 was, say, 3,800, 3,900, 3,700. They got out, and the market went a little lower, and then it turned. And as they raised interest rates, the market managed to challenge and fight back and rise along with rising interest rates, market now 4,400. Those who exited cannot get back in because they want something called confirmation bias. They want to be proven correct with their theory that I'm going to sell and, well, buy back and avoid the conflict and then the turmoil of the market. I'll buy back at better times. Well, better times are now, which are higher levels. So the confirmation bias is not kicking in. And here they sit at watching markets rise. Don't do it, my good friends. Sure, you can rotate around the board, but don't exit. It's just too difficult to get back in for the professionals, let alone the do-it-yourselfers. Amos Nadler, he's a founder and chief scientist at Professor of Wall Street. I should say Prof of Wall Street. He's involved in behavioral economics research and emphasis on digital assets, research, finance, marketing, leadership, making material improvements in the industry. But what I like about Amos is he specializes in behavioral finance, neuroeconomics, and econometrics, economic analysis. That's not so exciting. And even healthcare, marketing, branding, identity. And wow, it's a lot you do there, Amos. Welcome back to Hi-Fi Radio. I appreciate your time. Please eloquently describe behavioral finance to us and confirmation bias, I should say, to us in the world of behavioral finance and why is just such a mind blank.
Well, thank you all for the invite and great to hear your voice as well, Jack. Confirmation bias is certainly one of the tough ones that, as you said, professionals struggle with, individual investors, do-it-yourselfers struggle with. And the big challenge there is that it's tough to thrust aside data that contradicts our beliefs. And this was a quote, I think it was Thucydides, you know, back in the days, as a Greek classical historian talks about thrusting aside what we do not want to maintain the beliefs that we have. And your example now of people not being in the market because, well, I believe it's going to go down, and therefore I'm going to do X, and then the market doesn't go down. Well, I'm still going to hold true to this idea. It's the opposite of what we call being a Bayesian updater. Bayesian updating is a type of mathematical updating that makes you an objective forecaster based on the information that you have. Humans, we all struggle with this inability to be a Bayesian updater, a mathematical updater, but we tend to overemphasize the data that supports our hypothesis. So you could say, oh, there's this war going on. I think things are going to hit the fan. I'm going to stay out. You could mention other things happening. You could always have a laundry list of negative or bare sort of theses, and then that's your belief. You'll cast aside, well, there's good economic data, the job reports are good, there's these breakthroughs in these areas, this is improving. So if you've kind of staked out a position, you're going to underemphasize or just completely ignore the data that contradicts your perspective.
You know, it's funny, I sort of feel that way, that I'm contradicting data when it comes to the Canadian market. The Canadian market is not working very well. Our Canadian pipelines, which were, you know, widow and orphan type names, big fat dividend payers, steady, consistent, you know, they're always moving stuff around the country and they're not building more pipe. They're not working. Canadian banks, house money, shall I say, not working. And the data is just, you know, the data to me is the momentum, what the market is saying with price and volume and notably price. The data is pointing to, hey, these things aren't working. But my bias is hang on to them into next year. Every dog has its day. And I do know over time, these names do end up compounding wealth. But I'm struggling with it right now, Amos.
Mm-hmm. That's a tough one. I've worked with a lot of Canadian professionals, and home bias is a huge one for Canadians. This is one of the biases we find in the literature that basically means that people like to buy equities of the country they live in. And there's a lot of reasons why we do that. And I think psychologically it gives us a sense of safety, familiarity, control, and putting money into foreign assets, even if it's, you know, 2 hours south or, you know, heading out to the U.S., there's a sense of lack of familiarity, sense of lack of control, which I would say is an illusion of control. But Canadians in the world are the worst in terms of having home bias because the percentage of their portfolios is the highest of any other industrialized nation that holds Canadian assets to their detriment. Wolf, you're not alone. A lot of other people struggle with this idea. Banks work, you know, oil and gas has been great. So I'm struggling to justify this position when there's evidence that saying there's better money, you know, better investments elsewhere. You got to go with the data, and you know there's no sort of easy way, but trusting your gut is not the way to make investment decisions.
Well,
lead you astray there.
Jack and I are running about seven or eight portfolios with different flavor and style, and some of our new portfolios that we built are data driven. They're quant driven with a technical overlay, and they are as refined to becoming a process as we have ever seen on the street, Bay Street, that is. And it's interesting to see what names it's telling us to buy. Jack, in that Bloomberg portfolio that you're running with some of your money, give me a couple of names that it told you to buy that are up that you never would have bought. Give us
sure,
three names.
Absolutely. I'm going to say the housing sector earlier in the year. We talked about it, Wolf. I said I would never buy these names. And again, that's an emotional bias that I had. The market was telling us something different. The quants were telling us something different. And this process actually put us in a couple names that gave us a lot.
So housing, what was the other one?
Yeah, I would say D.H. Horton in terms of housing and Pulte. We were very early on those two names. And then the energy space drove us into that. I'm going to say, you know, the world is going green. Everyone's got that narrative going on right now, but these companies are making a lot of money, and we've got three or four energy names that are doing quite well in that Bloomberg portfolio.
That was a Bloomberg portfolio. So that was just a strictly quant portfolio. Then we have a quant technical portfolio, which is getting a little closer to our own style. But then our own style, I basically almost am taking quants, technicals, and I'm overlaying gray matter, Jack's gray matter and my gray matter, and to see if we are able to add value. And, well, again, we are biased towards the answer yes, but I do think we are able to add value. But almost, I'm going to say that, you know, if I am able to add value, which I believe I can, and we call that alpha on the street, it is only because I have been investing on Bay Street, good golly, since my early 20s, and I'm now 58. That's a long time. That's about 38 years. Wow. Professionally, I've been working on Bay Street now for 22 years. I began 9/11. I kid you not. It's a very powerful Remembrance Day to me and many of us, of course, which we just went through the 22nd. Yeah. God rest all those individuals' souls and all their families, indeed. Amos, can you please help us? Top three most common behavioral mistakes investors make.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the most of the audience, because there's a sort of a difference between the do-it-yourselfers and the professionals. You guys also make mistakes, and I love your humility on the show that you openly talk about that. I think that's very commendable. The literature, most of the research is on do-it-yourselfers, just because of availability of data, you know, easier to get access to them. So the main one is one that I don't know how often is discussed, but over-trading, I know you guys talk about it, but over-trading, just the act of excessive volume, is one of the big ones, that retail do-it-yourselfers react to news, buy and sell, react to what happened previously. Prices go up, they do things. Prices go down, they do things. So that's one that people struggle with. There's other biases associated with that, such as illusion of control. I believe I can control what's happening. The fact is we're all atomistic unless you're a billionaire. So that's a major one.
Illusion of control. That's cool.
Yes. You want to? We could chat about that one.
Give us the third, and then we'll pick the best one to chat about.
Okay, so we talked about overtrading, just the act of excessive volume. So overconfidence, that's a big one, which I know you guys have talked about on the show quite a bit.
Overconfidence.
That's, and it has a few different flavors. It's not only this idea that, you know, I know better than everyone. There's this type that's called, there is over-precision, believing that the data you have gives you more information than it does. There's the better than average effect, which is another subset of overconfidence, saying, well, I'm better than everybody else.
Better than average.
Yeah, that's a classic overconfidence. type, but there's like these kind of three types of overconfidence. And in trading, it just destroys people's performance because they place large positions on ideas that are not particularly well vetted. And then when that, you know, that goes well or doesn't go well, they're going to mismanage the loss and the gain, which is what the disposition effect is about, which I think is a good candidate for the third one. The disposition effect is investors selling the winners too soon, missing out on the big upside. And on the loss side, people not selling them too early or at all.
I think that's the biggest. In my opinion, that's the biggest, not getting out of your losing trades, because that means you're wrong, and that means you have to admit that you are wrong. And wait a minute, you thought you were better than average. We call that being smarter than the average bear on Bay Street. Amos Nadler, founder and chief scientist at Prof of Wall Street. Always a treat to get your perspective on us mortal creatures and how we take a bar of soap and, well, turn it into foam. Yeah, don't overtrade, my good friends, because the portfolio is like a bar of soap. The more you use it, the smaller it gets. Amos, all the best to you, my friend. We'll speak soon. Philanthropy, giving, helping, sharing the love. It's the responsibility for those who have. And this show is all about helping you have more. And therefore, with that big, well, with that power comes big responsibilities. Covenant House Executive Sleepout coming up very, very soon. Mark Austin, Executive Director, is going to join us and talk about the importance of Covenant House and helping homeless youth. Stay tuned.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Hi-Fi Radio in a moment on 640 Toronto. You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.
You, my friend, can be a hero. Mark Austin is executive director at Covenant House. He's going to spend some time with us, speak to us about the executive sleepout. And friends, you can certainly, like I said, be a hero. Either call Mark and become a sleeper or donate some money. You help me become the top fundraiser, my good friends. I greatly appreciate that. A few years ago when I did the sleepout, yes, you helped me be the number one sleeper for just one day. Mark, thank you for spending some time with us. It's a very important time of the year, certainly for Torontonians living on the street. Appreciate you doing everything you do and spending some time with us today. How are you?
I'm great, thank you, Wolfgang, and thank you so much for having me on the show. As you said, our 12th year of the executive sleepout is coming up in November, and we're starting to sort of get motivated and fundraise for that really important cause. So we're so glad to have you on board again. I think, you know, you could potentially snag that top fundraiser spot again. So, you know.
I'm trying to actually get our managing director, Stuart Raftus, to seep out this year. And I think he's going to do it if he has no conflicting appointments. He does have to travel the planet a lot. And but nonetheless, it'd be great to see him do the sleep out, and I can pass the baton to him. But yeah, I've done it, I think, three or four times. And it's a very moving, humbling experience to actually sleep outside for even one day. You've obviously done it, Mark. Share with the audience your experience sleeping on some concrete for 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Wolfgang. It's an experience that really connects people to the work. I mean, the evening starts with a program at Covenant House where you can really learn about the services and programs Covenant House has to support young people who are homeless and trafficked in our city. But then, as you said, the evening ends with going out to the cold, hard pavement in Toronto in mid-November. And the objective there is to really give people some time to think about the issue of homelessness, what it's really like to have nowhere to go, and as I said, to really connect people to the work. And I think people rise to a challenge. So I think people actually enjoy the little bit of hardship that comes with it because they really are convinced they're doing something important, and they are. And I've heard many sleepers say that it's been a really life-changing experience for them.
Yeah, well, I've met a number of fantastic sleepers over the number of years I did it, and I will say they're very committed individuals, very passionate, very humbled, and very successful. Hence, the executive sleep out. I'm trying real hard to raise the bar. Help people elevate out of poverty, and also avoid poverty. It's remarkable in the world of wealth, because it's almost a bit of a dirty word. Not as bad as rich. I'm okay with the word, but some people don't like the word. But nonetheless, we got to have something, some kind of descriptive for it. But it's amazing how a small token can go so far. And let's speak about the audience right now. I keep saying to the listeners, please begin saving and begin saving soon and investing. And I always say a homeless person saving $5 a day for 40 years at 9%. So $5 a day saved at a 9% growth rate, which is, right in line with what the U.S. and the Canadian stock market have done over the last 75 years, would generate almost $750,000. it's amazing. I can flip that now back into donating, $5 a day and what kind of impact that can have on not just yourself, but society as a whole. Again, taking care of youth is costly. So how much does it cost to take one youth through the Covenant House process, program, facilities for one day?
Well, depending on what services are being provided to them, Wolfgang, that cost could vary. But if you're looking at, for example, at being in our residence, that's $200 to $300 per day per young person for a safe environment, an environment where they're provided nutritious food, access to health services, access to counseling. So just some of those basic things is really quite resource intensive. But as you noted, Covenant House is really dependent on community support. Over 3/4 of the revenue that supports the work of Covenant House comes from donors from the community. So we are incredibly grateful for that, and we just know how important it is. And just quickly on another note, because young people have so much potential, their whole lives ahead of them, Covenant House really leans into the whole financial literacy area too. And a number of our programs set up trust and savings accounts so young people can begin to build that financial base that they will need when they move out to the community. So we're doing that work as well.
Mark, I had a client just work through their will and estate plan with me. And this individual has a $2.5 million current net worth. About $1 million is in their RSP, and they have no children. So they're going to donate 75% of their estate to three relatives, shall I say, and the other 25% of their estate to a charity. I want to go through the math in this one here. The RSP at date of death is fully taxable, which means $1 million RSP with no other income probably work out to about $400,000 in taxes. This individual, again, has no children, and they've given the bulk of their money to family, but some to charity. Say, well, look, if I give $500,000 to charity, I will reduce my tax bill by $250,000. And yeah, my net estate will be $250,000 smaller, but I'm going to have a $500,000 charitable impact at the estate level. You must, through Covenant House, have individuals who are that passionate about your organization that they actually write Covenant House as a beneficiary into their wills?
We absolutely do, and it's an important component of the support that we receive from the community. And we have our own in-house expert, Ruth, who handles all the estate and legacy and planned giving. So it's a really important part of how people support Covenant House and support homeless youth in our city. And as you say, there are obvious advantages as well to some of the tax situation and related to that.
Well, yeah, there's nothing wrong with saving tax and also helping out Covenant House. Look, we're speaking with Mark Astin. He's executive director at Covenant House. They're gearing up for their 12th annual executive sleepout in the middle of November in this cold, chilly city of ours. We're trying to raise a lot of money for a very, very important cause that just, well, it always exists, and we got to minimize it. I'll share with you a few of my homeless experiences, witnesses, when I was traveling through Europe. It's remarkable. You just can't avoid it. Hi-Fi Radio, show about money. We want you to have more of it. Turn it up. We are your friend. Indeed. Stay tuned.
Want to make more money? Stay tuned for more Hi-Fi Radio on 640 Toronto. You're listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.
Love Bob. Appropriate for Covenant House Executive Sleepout, 12th annual. It's gaining some traction, but never enough. Mark Astin is joining us. Mark, I've been fortunate this year. I took a couple of trips to Europe, just blessed, and managed a couple of days in a few different countries. And yes, I was in England. I understand you're a native from England, beautiful country, and spent obviously time in London, and that's a gorgeous city. It's actually, I'm going to say, probably the nicest city in the world. It's clean, it's hopping, it's busy, architecturally brilliant. The food is very good, surprisingly. That's what everyone says. Surprisingly, the food in England is actually really good. That's what people say. It's true. It is good. Virtually no homelessness, Mark. Let's start with England, because then we're going to take a trip to Ireland, where you see a very different picture. Now, I understand that there's different, obviously, different laws. That's what's interesting when you travel as well. Laws change. They are not the same. You got to be aware of local laws. But there's some interesting laws globally in terms of the ability to sleep on a street. And I think the ones in England are basically you cannot set up camp. You cannot have any kind of mattress or virtually not even cardboard on the ground. You can sleep on the ground, but that's about as far as it goes. Are you aware of that nuance and that law, Mark, in London?
Well, just let me say, firstly, yes, London in many regards is an incredible city, though I have to give a second mention to Manchester, the home of Manchester United, my football club. So, but yes, I mean, Wolfgang, you know, I think it's pertinent to mention rough sleeping in London, because there's been a huge amount of work done to really try and reduce and mitigate rough sleeping in London. Now, I couldn't tell you what the bylaws are in that city currently, but I know it has certainly been an area of emphasis because, look, and you come to a world-class city and you expect certain things. And I think one is that, you know, a city like that can provide basic shelter to people who are living there. So I think London's worked very hard on that.
Well, that's good to hear. I saw some homelessness, not very much. Then I went a month ago to Dublin. Rampant homelessness there. It's incredible, the homelessness in that city and the excessive drug abuse, heroin, crack. They have an issue, and that is not a climate to be homeless in. Ireland, you get four seasons the same day.
There are trends that are global, Wolfgang, and I think, you know, since the pandemic, we've seen a rise in anxiety, trauma, mental health issues. We've certainly seen in Toronto, and I know elsewhere in the globe, an intensification of addiction. There are some really lethal street drugs now. So all of those issues, plus in many cities, the incredibly unaffordable cost of housing.
Bingo.
These factors have come together to make it really difficult for people. So Covenant House, I mean, is working really hard on all those fronts for young people.
Affordability is front and center. Jack and I, we speak about it all the time. And I don't know, I don't like to play the blame game, but there are some key factors here that make living in a shelter very difficult, meaning buying a home. Number one, money was too cheap for too long, i.e. zero interest rates took housing prices to the moon. Politicians are not allowing builders to build them. And builders are saying, if you're not going to allow us to make money building them, we certainly aren't going to build them. Notably, rental housing does not make economic sense for developers. They don't want to do it because they can't make money on it. The policies do not line up with the demand. And the demand is compounded with immigration. I speak now back to Europe. They have a major refugee crisis and have had one over the last 10 years. And Germany has been bringing in millions, plural, of people. There again, I saw a lot of Turkish homelessness. Dublin, people are coming from the Middle East with a million euro. That gets their whole family into Dublin or into Ireland and they get themselves a family European passport. But again, there are no new houses being built. Does that discussion ever come up? I'm going to give you about 30 seconds with that, Mark, in terms of building more shelters.
Both are critical. We now have a situation in Toronto where the shelter system is full every night. We need more capacity there. But as you've noted, we need good policy and good implementation of for affordable housing. We need to incent developers and not-for-profit developers so we can start to address the crisis we have in Toronto.
Mark Austin, Executive Director at Covenant House, I do wish you great success with the sleep out. If there are executives who want to join the cause and sleep on the street, I highly encourage you. Your website would have information on that?
Absolutely, covenanthousetoronto.ca.
The requirement if you're an executive, I think, is what? You have to at least commit to trying to raise $5,000, isn't that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Yes.
I managed to raise just under $90,000 with the great help of our listeners at Hi-Fi Radio. It's a great cause, and I please support it, either with a check, donating stock, you can write them into your will if you like, or actually hit the pavement for about 7 hours. So important to give back, my good friends. Like I said, get started early. And you know something, if you can't start early, start now. The sooner you start, the sooner you build wealth. Slow, steady Eddie does win the race. And yes, as boring and vanilla as it sounds, you got to stay invested. Don't get shaken out. Just too difficult. Own quality throughout the process. $5 a day at 9% over 40 years is $750,000. $1,000 a month at 9%, my good friends, 40 years, about $5 million. That's what you should have. Keep listening to us each and every Saturday right here on 640. It's Hi-Fi Radio. I'm Wolfgang Klein. Any questions for Jack Hartle or myself? We're both portfolio managers here to help you build wealth. Please give us a call. Have a good weekend.
You've been listening to Hi-Fi Radio with Wolfgang Klein and Jack Harthill, portfolio managers at Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management. For questions about today's show or any questions about money, email wolfandjack@wolfgangklein.com. Hi-Fi Radio, for the love of money. Join us again next week. The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of Corus Entertainment.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.